You're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, just here to let you know that this episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's almost August, almost fair season, almost harvest time. In fact, it is harvest time for a lot of our summer fruits and veggies. Things got planted outside a little late this spring. Remember how wet and cool it was? But we're making up the difference now for a lot of crops and a lot of gardeners. So we thought it would be a good day to take stock and check in with garden consultant Charlie Nardozzi, who also hosts the Vermont Garden Journal here on VPR. He's going to offer some tips and tricks, suggestions for ways to get the most out of what you've got growing now, and how to get ready for the second half of the growing season. Charlie, hi, nice to talk to you.
Hi, Jane, how are you?
I'm great. And, you know, I'm going to get it right out of the gate that I didn't do a garden this year. So
what?
I know. I'm excited to talk with you, though, because it's almost as good as gardening. And when you and I talk, everything blooms, everything is a beautiful vegetable, and, you know, the pests are somebody else's problem. So this is always fun for me.
That's good. It's your virtual garden.
Exactly. What's in your actual garden right now that is... coming to fruition?
Well, right now, all the summer crops are coming in, the warm season crops. So the tomatoes and the eggplants and the squashes and the cucumbers and the kales and the chards and all those kinds of crops that we really yearn for when you think of summer in Vermont. Now they're all happening, and they're all happening really quickly because we've had this spate of really warm, humid weather that's been pushing things along, and it probably will continue into August.
You know, I always wish that there was a way to do more staggered planting of those mid-season crops, because it feels like you've got nothing for a long time, and then it's like you're an animal. You're trying to eat all the tomatoes for 3 weeks straight, or can them, or and life gets in the way. Can you actually stagger things like tomatoes and cucumbers so that you have some coming now, coming ripe now, and some coming ripe later in August?
Well, you've probably been to our house because that's how we are out there in the garden right now. We're just foraging away. You know, the dogs, myself, my wife, everyone is
the rabbits.
The rabbits are just eat. Certain crops you can stagger. Certainly, we've talked in the past about succession planting. So putting cool season crops in, and then when they're done, putting in the warm season crops, and then going back to the cool season crops. But even within those warm season crops, you can plant like early season tomatoes and mid and late season tomatoes. And if you stagger those, you will get overlap for sure, because we have such a short summer here. It's going to happen overlap. But the main part or the main harvest of those crops will come in early, mid, and late season. So those are some of the things you can think about for next year when you're planning your garden. Is think about the early pepper and then the late pepper. You know, a lot of the hot peppers, like the habaneros, for example, are going to be later in the season, whereas you can get some of the early jalapenos that will mature a little bit earlier in the year. And with things like squash and cucumbers, you can stagger the planting a little bit. So you can try an early crop. If we get blessed with a warm, dry spring, which we didn't get this year. So if you did try that, it didn't work. But you can try an early crop of squash and cucumbers and get a little bit jump on the season, and then try one in June, maybe towards the end of June or so. Try a late crop that's going to be maturing in September or so. And this is especially true in your warmer parts of the state. So in the Champlain Valley, the Connecticut River Valley, places where we have a little extended fall, you can get away with having those warm season crops later in the season.
Even if it's the same species, because, you know, you mentioned like tomatoes or peppers, you can have the early ones and the later ones. But if you like, let's say pickling cucumbers, I feel like the cucumbers are my frenemies because they just hide. You know, you think you've got them all, and then you go out the next day and one is a foot long and it wasn't there yesterday.
I swear it wasn't there.
I know.
So I looked under every leaf.
So it sounds like with some things like cucumbers, you can actually stagger even within the same crop, you know, even within the same group. But for other ones, you're better off choosing an early variety or a late variety.
Right. And also picking early, just like you're talking about with the pickling cucumbers, for things like the squashes, summer squashes and cucumbers in particular, the more you pick, the more it's going to produce. And so you can, by staying on top of it, and if you're out there, I always tell people, if you're in doubt about picking it, pick it.
Right.
Because if you wait a day, you're going to forget, and then 2 days go by, and then you find the big, gigantic, ginormous zucchini in the garden.
That's when you take it into work.
Yes,
make
you
it,
do.
Make it your colleague's problem.
Or you hollow it out and float it down the river.
Let's go to Ken, who's calling in from Salisbury. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? this morning I had a question pop into my head for Charlie, and then I found out that he was on with you today, so it was a great coincidence. I followed Charlie's advice for planting pumpkins and squash. For the last several years, I plant them right on the edge of my garden and then let them trail out onto the lawn. So it's a real efficient way. It looks good. My question is, the parts of the pumpkin that trail back into the garden get pretty overwhelming. I try to train them away, but I'm wondering if I could just prune some of those off. It would keep the garden neater and perhaps make all the energy go to the pumpkins that are already out on the lawn.
All right, so Ken's line is a little bit sounds like he's underwater, although I hope he's not. But Ken wants to know about pruning pumpkins because, Charlie, you know, they trail everywhere and you can let them go all over your yard or, as Ken does, try to train them back into the garden. But can you actually just prune them?
Yes, and that was probably our first call from underneath Lake Champlain. That was a good one. So Ken's idea of pruning them back is a good one, especially, I'm not sure where Ken is, but especially if you're up in the Northeast
Salisbury.
Salisbury. Okay, so that's pretty warm. But if you're in the Northeast Kingdom in the mountainous areas where you have an even shorter growing season, cutting them back allows all that energy to go into those first fruits that set, so you'll be guaranteed to get a pumpkin that's ripe before the frost comes. So that's one of the reasons why you want to cut them back, is to really focus that energy. You do that with melons all the time, cantaloupes and watermelons, trying to get the first couple fruits that set on the vine all mature before it gets too cold for them. But if you have a situation like Ken has, maybe where they're going everywhere, yes, you can cut off vines, or you can cut off the growth points, or you can, as he was trying to do, redirect them and cut them off, do a combination like that. And all that will do is just send more energy into the vines going out into the garden. It's kind of like a little bit of a specialized pruning that you're doing of your pumpkins.
What if you want a 400-pound pumpkin? What do you do?
Go to the fair.
If you want it in your garden,
Charlie.
Oh,
your garden. Okay, yes. So the professional pumpkin growers, the giant vegetable growers, if you go to any of the fairs that are happening pretty soon, you'll see some of them exhibiting there. They have a whole recipe of how they do this. It all starts with getting the right variety. They're all some kind of variation of what we call the Atlantic giant pumpkin, which is one that puts on a lot of weight really fast. It looks like that flattened tractor tire sitting in the garden. You've seen those. So that's what you want to start with, is getting the seed, and they trade seed, and they have like special societies probably where you can get some seeds. I'm not sure how they get them, but they all get their seed that they need for that year. Then they start growing them, and when they're growing them out to get the giant pumpkin, they're waiting for those pumpkins to set one or two fruits, and then that's it. They don't let any other set. They cut off all the flowers, all the young fruits. They put a lot of fertilizer on it, a lot of energy in it. They sometimes put little tents of plastic over the plants so they stay warm early in the season. And the whole idea is to really send as much energy as you can into those giant pumpkins that have the genetics to get really big, like 4, 5, 6, 7, even 1,000 pounds.
Wow. So it's sort of an extreme version of what Ken could be doing by pruning.
Yes, it's a very extreme version.
So, Charlie, I mentioned pests in our tease of the show, and I know you want to talk about a lot of them, but one that didn't – well, wasn't something that we necessarily thought we were going to be talking about is a question that Deb has for us. So Deb writes in to say, I live in Burlington, and I need advice on repelling neighborhood cats from using my garden as a litter box. Are there plants to grow or concoctions to spray that will be effective?
Well, you could give your neighbor some catnip and have them planted in their yard. That'll probably keep the cat over there. But cats do like to roam around, and if they have a nice soft bed that you've tilled up to plant your seeds in there, that is a perfect spot for a kitty litter box. And so that's why they want to go into it. So what I've suggested that people do is to get some materials that make that kitty litter box very unappealing to cats, and yet you can still grow things in there. So it could be anything from thorns from a buckthorn tree or thorns from a rose bush or brambles like blackberries, and lay those canes down in that area so that when the cat comes through and tries to move its way in there, it's not going to like it very well. And so it'll try to find some other place to do its business. So that's probably the best thing you can do. If you don't have those canes or you just don't like the look of it, you can always try to put some kind of mesh or wire mesh over it as well to keep the cat out. But anything that's going to make it unappealing for them is probably the best way to go about keeping them out. Sprays and things like that generally don't work very well for so long.
And there aren't any plants that are just going to give off a scent or something that
that'll repel them? Not that I'm aware of. I know, of course, the catnip is something that they like. So you can use the opposite psychology on them and put a catnip plant somewhere else in your yard and let them go over there and just have a great old time. But they still may wander back over into the bathroom area.
Or just get a sandbox. We had one as a kid and we had to get rid of it because our neighbor's cats used that.
There you go. You can create a little porta potty for them.
Sharon's calling in from Brandon. Hi, Sharon. Go right ahead.
Hi. This summer, I seem to have every bug imaginable. Cucumber beetle, squash beetle, potato beetle, and even tomato cutworm. Help!
What happened, Sharon?
I don't know. It's just they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. Well, yes. Sometimes, you know, I'm sure we can get another call if someone will say that they've had a good year and not many pests. So it becomes a very regional thing. There are some things you can do in your vegetable garden that will help with pest control in general. One, of course, is to rotate crops, not planting the same type of plant in the same spot for 3 to 4 years. So that way the pests don't build up in the soil there. The other is to try to get knocked down weedy areas around your garden, them down or string trim them down, because that's often a place where they will hide or they'll overwinter so that they can come back and reinvade. You can also look for resistant varieties. There are certain varieties. For example, the squash vine borer doesn't like butternut squash. And so you can plant butternut squash in lieu of planting maybe some pumpkins or Hubbard squash. There are varieties that have some resistance to some of these pests. And of course, the other thing is to kind of understand a little bit about the pest you're dealing with and staying on top of it by squishing eggs early in the season, like this time of year. You want to look at the undersides of your zucchini and summer squash and winter squash leaves and look for these copper-colored eggs. Those are squash bug eggs. And if you just leave them, they will turn into these gray squash bugs that will inundate your plants by August. But if you keep squishing them or cutting them out, if you're a little squeamish about squishing them, you can just cut them out, throw them into soapy water, and that will disrupt the whole generation, and so you won't have that problem. So there are a number of different cultural things you can do to help in general with pests in the garden.
All right, let's stay on the pest tip here for a little while, Charlie. And listeners, mm-hmm. if you have pest questions or if you want to take us in a different direction, we got to talk about some of the other stuff too. Give us a call. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your comments and questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. But we'll do some rapid fire pest control here with you, Charlie. And okay. One is from Patty in Willsboro, New York, who says, something is eating the petals off my purple coneflowers. I have about 9 plants in various parts of my garden. I have found 2 Japanese beetles on one of them, but that's all. Is something else the culprit?
I would check for footprints because, you know, deer will eat pretty much anything. And if you see some animal footprints wandering around, deer especially, because, of course, the coneflowers are tall enough, they might just nibble off the petals and leave that sticky cone in the middle undisturbed. So that would probably be my first inclination, is think of an animal versus an insect. Certainly Japanese beetles eat over 300 different kinds of plants, so I'm sure Echinacea is on that list somewhere. So they will go after them, and you'll see them cause some damage. But if it looks like it's a clean, like someone nibbled it, you know, like you kind of nibbled right around the edge of it and there's nothing left, then it's more likely an animal. And then, of course, you'd have to put some fencing or repellent sprays up.
All right. So from deer to deer, here's Will in Shelburne. Hi, Will. You're on air. Go right ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I'm just wondering if you have any tips on how to keep deer away. I pretty much have deer eating everything from the evergreens to sedum that's flowering. And I'm just having trouble keeping them off property. So if you could give me any tips on what to do there, that would be great.
Okay, sure. I can do a little deer 101. So the first thing is the fail-proof way to take care of deer is to put up a fence. And that's just something that it's a big expense. It may not look that great, but if you really want to keep deer out of your garden or out of your property, a 6 to 7 foot tall fence is what you're going to need. We put a wire fence around our vegetable garden when we first built our home out in the country in a deer yard, basically. And it's kept them out pretty much the whole time, except for when we forgot to close the door and then they all came in.
That would do it.
They figured that out. I was amazed that they figured that out. Oh, the door is open. Let's go in. So all around the garden, that's kept them out. So if you really want to have a good garden and not have to deal with deer eating everything under the sun in your yard, start with a fence. So the big electric fence – or excuse me, a big wire fence, or you can try an electric fence. Some people have had good success with those, especially if they come in and they get shocked early in the season. Then they may learn not to come back again. So you can try that if you want to do something that's a little less impact on the environment. The other method, of course, are repellent sprays. And you always want to look at repellent sprays that are scent-based, not taste-based, because they don't want to, you don't want your plants to be eaten down and then they decide they don't like them afterwards. So look for ones that have a smell that they don't like, and they can be anything from a garlic-type product to cayenne peppers to rotten eggs or putrescent eggs. I always love that name, putrescent eggs. And slaughterhouse waste or blood meal. That's another one that works really well. And the key with repellents is to apply them often as the plant grows, of course. The young growth is not protected. And to rotate the types of materials you're using so they don't get used to any one scent. You can mix in some home remedies, everything from the Irish Spring soap to the human hair to coyote urine. To any kind of thing that you might imagine might work for them. But any kind of smell like that is going to be one that they get used to. And after they get used to it, they'll just munch away anyway. So those are the two main ways that you're going to keep deer away from your garden.
All right. Okay. So I promised a few more here on the pest side of things. So Christina in Cornwall is having rabbit trouble. She writes, "This is the most discouraging gardening year ever. After battling rain and mosquitoes, I was finally rejoicing in my flowers and herbs, only to find that rabbits started eating all of my impatiens and sage down to the roots. They also ate my marigold flowers, which I plant to keep rabbits out. I've tried mixing cayenne pepper with oil, but I have not seen much success. Charlie, can you please help Christina?"
Yes, we will try. Well, like the deer, I think fencing is probably going to be the best idea to keep rabbits out. And if you can think about a fence, you don't have to think of obviously a 7-foot fence for a rabbit, unless you have really big rabbits. But something that's low and something that you can actually tuck down into the ground a little bit, because rabbits will dig. Mostly they're not, you know, the old axiom, the dumb bunny. That's kind of what rabbits do. You know, they come up to a fence, they look around, they maybe try one way or that way, then they move on to something else. They don't have a long attention span. So if you can have a fence there that goes down into the ground a little bit, that's going to stop them from tunneling underneath it and hopefully hopping over it if it's a tall enough fence. And that would be the best thing. Now, all these repellent sprays, like I was mentioning before, and she mentioned the cayenne pepper and the garlic and all those, they will work to a certain degree. But if a rabbit or a deer or any animal is hungry enough, they will just eat right through whatever it is that they smell.
All right, so we're going a little bit smaller now with Bob up north, who says, "A clover field I planted for pollinators is being destroyed every year by moles or voles tunneling under it during the winter. I've tried above and below ground specialty traps with zero success. I can't flood them out because it's a drainage field. I've even stuffed hair donated by a local barbershop down the holes. Someone suggested I bury speakers sealed in yogurt containers and play Celine Dion or AC/DC. Does subterranean audio work? Any suggestions?"
Oh, Celine Dion. She's not going to like that. You know that.
Well, and I don't know. I mean, maybe the voles really like Canadian pop stars.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Maybe put the speakers on the other side of the yard and they'll go be attracted to it. And they'll bring their picnic and they'll go over there and listen to her sing. Well, I haven't heard about the Celine Dion or AC/DC method of getting rid of moles and voles. But there is a product that's an organic product, very safe product to use that has been proven effective. And that's castor oil. And castor oil is not the stuff you get at the grocery store that's been deodorized. You want to get the stuff that's for garden use. It has a strong smell to it. You spray that or sprinkle that around those areas, and the moles and voles don't like that smell, and they get very agitated, and they'll get very active for a while, and then they'll take off and go somewhere else. So I would suggest you try that.
All right. So try that perhaps before the speakers that you're using to play subterranean music for these animals. I'd like to live in that place, actually.
Well, you know, unless they like the music, and then you can do a little bit of both.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good – see, there we go. Let's go to Herb, who's calling in from Shelburne. Hey, Herb.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Couldn't come at a better time. I am in right now weeding the garden. I have an invasive weed that started, about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's eventually spreading to about a 40-foot length garden. It's quite, I guess it's large for just a couple of people. What it does is it sends out these vines that wrap around wrap around everything, and then it strangles it. And when you try to pull them out, you find that it might have four or five or six different roots. So mm-hmm. you might pull out two or three, but you still got three left, and it comes right back. I'm at loss to know what to do. One thought was just to put a cover over the whole garden for one summer and just kill everything. And then maybe it would die that year. But I hate to give up a garden for the summer.
Yeah. Herb, good conundrum. Charlie, what do you think?
Well, it sounds like it might be bindweed, which is a very common weed around here. It looks kind of like a wild morning glory almost. But it does vine around and strangles plants and kind of just takes over an area. As far as the control of it goes, Herb's got a good idea as far as maybe removing some of those plants that he really likes in there and sacrificing the rest of them. Mow the whole thing down, throw some heavy-duty plastic or a tarp over that area, and just leave it dormant for a season. And then the year after that, what you want to do is pull back that tarp and then it will still grow. You will not kill it from 1 year. That's nothing. But what you will do is set it back. And at that point, you can start pulling it out as it starts sprouting because it'll be one of the first things that will sprout more so than grasses or other things that are there. And try to remove as much of the root system as possible. That's really the only sure way to try to get rid of it is to just try to stay on top of it. And I would suggest if you have a 40-foot long border, that's a big border, to do maybe section after section of it. And then after you're done with one section, put in some deep edging between that finished section and the one that still has the weed so that way it doesn't get reinvaded again.
Charlie, you gave similar advice. I think it was just about a year ago. It might have been in our spring gardening show because I, like Herb, was just so pessimistic. I have, I think, like three different species of something similar to bindweed that hang around my house, and they're like choking our lilacs and everywhere. And you said you have to be on top of it. You just have to fight it and fight it and fight it, and it's going to take a couple of years, and it's not going to be fun. And so, Herb, to give you a little bit of hope, I have been doing that over the past year and a half now in certain parts of – I've chosen one part of my yard and then another part, and I've actually gotten it. I beat it back, Charlie. So,
yes.
Yeah, in one spot, it's not there at all. And
look,
I talk to it, Herb. I tell it. I actually out loud say, you are not going to beat me. I am going to get you, and I'm going to kill you. And it's the only time I allow my children to talk like that, too, where we say, we are going to kill you until you're gone. And you know what? It works.
But do you play Celine Dion to it?
That's — we haven't tried that. I think it would grow tall. It would grow tall and blossom again.
And blossom and speak French.
Probably it would. Marilyn can't grow squash. Marilyn writes, we're new gardeners. For the third year, we've planted summer squash. We get lots of blossoms, but no veggies. What could be the problem?
Well, summer squash and melons and winter squash, almost all of those plants have male and female flowers. And so in order to get fruit, you need to have a little ambassador, you might say, go from the male flower to the female flower, and a little mm-hmm. hanky-panky happening, and mm-hmm. then bam, you got yourself a fruit. So if you're not having enough bees around, bees, bumblebees, honeybees, native bees, those kinds of bees, which could be due to just not having the population in your area, also it could be due to this bad weather, cold, cloudy weather, the bees aren't flying. So that often will be the case, and that's probably why this year many people have said that, you know, a lot of those cucumbers, squashes are late because we had such cool, cloudy weather early in the season in June. So that would be one of the things that you'd have to take a look at, is just make sure you have a population of bees. And the way to attract them to your garden is to grow a bunch of different flowers and grow early blooming flowers, everything from crocuses, for example, scillas. Really have a whole list of flowers that are blooming right up until bloom time of your squashes that are there. And they could be annual flowers that you get at a garden center. You want to stay away from flowers that are double flowers or unusual shape flowers for that type, because those are not going to be very attractive to the bees. The heirloom old-fashioned flowers are usually the best thing. So that would attract more bees into your garden and therefore more pollen. If you're still not getting it, then you can be the bee. You can get a cotton swab, go out around 10 o'clock in the morning when the flowers are in full bloom, they're opening up, look for a male flower, which is a flower that has a straight stem behind it, swish around your cotton swab inside, go find a female flower, which is a flower with a little squash or a little cucumber or whatever the plant is you're growing right behind the flower, swish that cotton swab in there, and then go back inside and just wait for magic to happen.
Can you still eat your squash blossoms if you're trying to make your squash blossoms turn into little squashes?
Yes, you can still eat your squash blossoms. Most of the squashes will produce more male flowers than female flowers. So if you want to go out there, and they only open for a day too. You might have noticed that, just like with daylilies. So after they're done opening, they start closing up, you can just pick them, saute them with a little olive oil, garlic, maybe some tomatoes, get a bottle of rosé.
So, Marilyn, at least if you have no veggies, you can still do something with the squash blossoms and
exactly.
Enjoy those. Frida in Belvedere says, I have 9 green bell pepper plants. Several of them had a rough start with odd puckering or wavy leaves and either no blossoms or blossoms dropping. Also, tons of cucumber blossoms, but no cucumbers. I thought calcium deficiency, so I added some bone meal and eggshells. Will this do the trick?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a calcium deficiency without, I think, doing a soil test. The bone meal certainly would add calcium to the soil, but it's an organic fertilizer that will be slow to break down. So I'm not sure you'd see the results of it that quickly. And she added bone meal and something else.
Eggshells.
Thank you. Eggshells, yes. And the eggshells will certainly, again, take a long time to break down and have any effect on the soil. So I would do a soil test before I would start adding things, thinking about, oh, I need this mineral or that mineral to them. Part of it probably was the weather. The cool weather was not conducive to peppers growing well, and you get that puckering. And the wet weather was not conducive because there's a lot of diseases, and you get all kinds of different foliar diseases on all kinds of different plants, including peppers. So that probably was causing the puckering of the leaves and just the formation of the leaves. Hopefully with this warmer weather that we've been having, that should all kind of be passed and the peppers will outgrow whatever infestation they have and will start producing more fruit. As far as the cucumbers go, I think it's the same issue that we were just talking about with pollination. And with cucumbers, you have the ability to get varieties that are parthenocarpic, meaning that they do not have to be cross-pollinated to actually get fruit on them. So you can look for that in the future if this is a reoccurring problem.
Parthenocarpic,
meaning that that's how you get those greenhouse cucumbers. Those are parthenocarpic, meaning that they will set fruit without having any cross-pollination between the male and female flower.
That's my vocabulary word for the day.
There you go.
Parthenocarpic. Mm-hmm. All right. Jack in Belvedere might have a tip for us. Jack, hi. Go right ahead.
Hi. So one caller earlier was talking about how to keep deer away from the garden. And one thing that a friend of mine had that seemed to be pretty effective is a motion-activated sprinkler. So whenever the deer come in the proximity of the garden, the sprinkler would go on and spray them away.
Yes, I've heard of people had success with that. Of course, you have to remember that it's there. and you also, if you have dogs or if you have the neighbor's cat or whatever.
Work for the cat, too.
That might work for the cat, too. Yeah, exactly. So, yes, if you can set it up and try it, it's worth a try.
Jack, thank you for that suggestion.
Jack.
We also had a caller who suggested planting chives to keep deer away.
Yeah, they tend not to like strong tasting plants like a chive, for example, or a mint plant is another one that's like that. But again, if they're hungry enough, they're going to munch away on things and they will be selective. If you put chives around a hosta plant, for example, they will find the hosta in the middle. They won't just kind of browse over it.
Let's go to Mike in Rutland Town. Hi, Mike. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great. You?
Good. I have a couple, or more than a couple, of Rose of Sharon trees in my yard on the south-facing wall, and they have been beautiful for about 4 or 5 years. They're about 6-7 feet tall. This past spring, they did not leaf out until very late. And then only about 30 to 50% of the branches leafed out. One of my neighbors has had the same issue, and we both agreed that the winter was a little longer, but not any harsher than normal. I was wondering if there is a source of that issue, and it was suggested wait a year. They may come back. Should I prune them back? All of what I perceive to be the dead growth? And let the other growth stay, or should I prune the whole thing back, or should I pull them out?
Okay.
What do you think, Charlie?
Well, Mike, yes, I think I would attribute it to the winter. I've seen a number of shrubs that have had a hard time leafing out this year, whether it was due to the absolute cold or just the timing of the cold. Often that sometimes will cause branches to die back, buds to not flower. Not so much that we had a warm or cold winter, but when the timing of that cold snap came was when the plant was more susceptible to it. So a Rose of Sharon is a borderline plant, even though you're in Rutland Town, which is one of the warmer parts of the state. It is definitely a zone 5 plant. So if you get a couple winters where it goes a little bit colder than normal, that is going to have an effect on it. But that being said, it is a tough plant too. So I would not pull it out, first of all. If you've had it for 5-6 years, it's probably a good size plant. I would cut back anything that looks that's dead, and you can cut back into the branch. And if you see, of course, brown inside the branch, it is dead. If you hit to a place where it's green or maybe a little green, little brown, go a little further down to where it's really green and prune to that point. And I would just kind of give it some – it's a little getting a little late to fertilize it. I hesitate saying to fertilize it, but maybe put some compost around it. And then in the spring, give it a little shot of fertilizer. That usually will help when you get plants like that that are just having a hard time leafing out in the spring. If you give them a shot of especially a soluble nitrogen fertilizer, like a fish emulsion, for example, that sometimes boosts them along and will push them to leaf out. And once they get going, then they're like kids, they won't stop.
So what if, like me, your approach is basically, just give it a year, see what happens? Are they likely to be okay next year if Mike does nothing?
Yes, they could very well. But if he has dead growth on them, that's obviously never going to come back. So mm-hmm. I would at least do that. I would at least prune out anything that's clearly dead. And then just give it some time. If it's a real prized Rose of Sharon and it's small enough after you've done the pruning, you could put some stakes around it and wrap burlap around it for the winter and see if that might protect it a little bit from the cold winds. Sometimes it's the cold winds that cause more damage than the absolute cold.
So everybody has a question, so let's keep going right with them. And one here from Deborah is actually a thank you. Deborah says, a big thank you to Charlie for the suggestion on a previous show that Japanese eggplant is a great choice for our area. I tried one for the first time this summer, and I'm really happy with the results. While the standard eggplant is still working to grow fruit worthy of harvest, we have had 3 meals from the Japanese plant. So Charlie, thank you from Deborah for that suggestion.
Oh, good. I'm glad for her.
And Andrea says, I just pulled up my pea plants and I want to plant a fall crop like radishes or spinach in its place. Is it too hot, too early to do that now? When should I replant the area?
Does it say where she's from?
No.
Okay. So yes, it may be a little hot, right? Especially right now because we're in the middle of a heat wave, to be putting things like spinach and radishes in the ground because they don't germinate well when the soil is really hot. So if you wanted to try to do that, the way to do it would be to water them really well once they're in the ground and then cover them like with a floating row cover or some material that'll provide some shade and keep the soil a little cooler. Now, if she's up in the mountains or in a cooler part of the state, then she probably could get away with planting them right now. I would say, though, within another week or so, it would be fine to go ahead and do that. The evenings will start – once we get into August, the evenings start getting cooler. You start getting that dew in the morning.
You promise?
I promise. I know you don't really like this hot weather, Jane. And then things will start growing well. So we, for example, just planted our second pea crop that I put in the ground. And I do have it covered and we're watering it really well. And peas will germinate in a little warmer temperatures. But you can also, at this time of year, put in things like kale, Swiss chard, beets, a fall crop of carrots, lettuces. There are some varieties of lettuces like the butter crunch and the bib lettuces that seem to germinate better in the hotter soil, the warmer soils. And really kind of think about your garden in the fall. I really encourage people to think about a fall garden for flowers and for fruits and for vegetables and herbs because we have been getting more extended falls as the climate changes and weather patterns shift around. Often you can get weather patterns where you go into October and November without a killing frost. And so that gives you a lot of time for plants to mature in the fall season.
Charlie, where do people go if they want to figure this stuff out and it's not a Vermont Edition Garden Show day or it's not a Vermont Garden Journal day? I mean, it's hard sometimes to know which variety you should be planting based on which soil you have, based on what your zone is. And maybe you don't even know what type of soil you have or what a fall crop would be versus a spring crop. So how do you learn these things other than having to spend hours of your day on the internet Googling.
Yeah, I would go to some of the seed companies. You know, certainly in Vermont, High Mowing is a good resource for that. And they do blogs and newsletters, and they have a lot of great information. And they are a Vermont-based seed company, and so they have trial grounds. They're growing things out. As I always would say, if they can grow it there at High Mowing, they probably could grow it anywhere in the state. So places that specialize in that information, you know, some of the garden centers will have that kind of information around the state too that might be able to help you find that information. And certainly the University of Vermont Extension Service, the Master Gardener Program, they have a helpline that you can call. And I think, I'm not sure which days, I think it's Wednesday, Thursday, but you can go onto their website and you can ask them and they'll do a little research for you. These are master gardeners who've been trained in gardening and they're paying back to the program by volunteering. And so they will go in and try to find out some information for you. So there are some resources out there that can help find that. And of course, keep listening to me.
Well, and Jim is on your helpline calling in from North Hero. Hi, Jim. Go right ahead. What's your question?
Hi. Hopefully you'll give me a two for one. Problem number one has been an ongoing problem with cucumber beetles. And I know, Charlie, you just did a show on them. And I'm using yellow sticky traps. I then moved on to pheromone yellow sticky traps, which did a much better job, but they're expensive, and I think to really control the problem, I need almost one per plant, and I've got about 50 cucumber, melon, squash-type plants, so that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. New in my arsenal this year was diatomaceous earth. Works well to keep them off the leaves, it seems, early, but the beetles seem to congregate in the blossoms, and I'm afraid to use it on the blossoms because the bees go in there as well, and I don't want to harm the bees. So problem number one, frankly, I'm at the point where I'm looking for a nuclear option on cucumber beetles. Okay. Problem number two, brand new to me this year, wilting tomato plants. It started about 7 to 10 days after transplant. First one, then a couple of days later, another one, then another one, and I lost about 60% of my transplants over a 2 to 3 week period. I've had no new wilt for the last 3 weeks, so I've got through something, but I've never experienced that before. I have no idea what caused it.
Are you growing heirloom varieties or hybrid varieties or a combination of tomatoes?
Combination, and, yeah. And it really hit the combination. It every type that I had, it hit.
Okay. Yeah. The cool, wet weather we had earlier in the season in June, that's very conducive to a lot of wilt diseases, root rot kind of diseases. So that's probably what I'm guessing is what happened to those tomatoes. And especially since you said in the last 3 weeks, it's really kind of turned around as the weather has turned around. So that's probably what was going on. And I think in the future, certainly heirlooms are great and I grow them and they're really nice to have. But sometimes they have disease issues, depending upon the variety. But some of the hybrids that are out there do have more resistance to some of those diseases. So you might want to check out some of the other varieties that are around. Raising beds up is a nice way if we have a cool, wet spring to make sure the soil drains out well and dries up and warms up fast, because that's what the tomatoes really like. And if you have clay soil, to amend that, you know, pretty heavily with some compost and organic matter, that'll help as well. As far as the cucumbers go, you've got a couple of my tricks already. You've been trying the yellow sticky traps and the diatomaceous earth. Those seem to work pretty well for me. You can also try kale and clay. That's another one. It's kind of like the diatomaceous earth. It's a powdery substance that they don't like very well. As far as keeping them off the plants, if you only had a few plants, I would suggest doing straw bale gardening. I've done that with cucumbers, and that works really well, getting them off the ground. And that might be something that you think about. It sounds like you have a lot of them, though, so that would be hard to – that's a lot of straw bales to do – 50 plants. But if you have a raised bed that you can raise them up and get them off the ground a little bit more, that might help with them a little bit. And the pheromone traps seem to work better, so that sounds like it. And since you're really concerned about the honeybees and spraying for those, there are some organic sprays like spinosad, for example, that work very well with cucumber beetles, but they are toxic to honeybees, especially when they're wet. So that might be something you could try early in the season when the bees aren't working the flowers, but of course, when the flowers come, you're probably going to have to try some other methods.
All right, let's go straight to Marge in Williston. Hi, Marge. Go right ahead.
Hi, Charlie.
Hi.
I'm calling about a distant bad relative of yours called Creeping Charles.
No relative of mine. I never saw him.
Well, it's taken over, or it's starting to take over our lawn, and my husband's out there all the time with a rake, and like just raking it and pulling it out, and it just seems to be this year spreading a lot.
Yes.
And we have in the past been just pulling it up, but I don't know, is there anything we can put on it or what?
Well, there really isn't anything. I mean, unless you want to use a chemical herbicide that will kill it. But the bigger problem is that it's growing in an area where the lawn grass probably isn't growing well, because it's an opportunistic weed and it's a ground ivy. So it spreads around, and wherever it can find spots that have bare ground or thin grass, that's where it'll move into. If you have a thick, lush lawn, then it won't really invade that much. Or if it does, it'll be easy to pull out. So that would be really the solution. If you can keep your husband at it, keep them hydrated, keep feeding them, give them suntan lotion, keep them out there pulling it out. But after he's done with that, as you get closer to the fall in August, September, come in with some compost to top dress that area, overseed with some new grass seed, and try to get the lawn thicker and lusher. And what that will do is that'll prevent it from reinvading. If you don't do that step, and if he does all this work to pull out the creeping Charlie, it'll just come back again and he'll eventually have to give up.
Hmm.
That
all right.
Be good.
Fine. Charlie, our colleague here at VPR, Anna, in South Hero, is a relatively new gardener. She says, this is my second year, and I've planted my Brussels sprouts next to my runner beans. Last night, I discovered tiny black circular pests on my sprouts. Could they be aphids? And is there a way to get rid of them that doesn't involve hosing down the plant, because the rental I live in doesn't have an outdoor spigot?
Oh.
What do you think?
Well, it could be. You know, aphids come in many different colors, white, green, pink, black. So if there's a lot of them, and if there's particularly on the new growth of the Brussels sprouts, it could very well be an aphid. If she can't spray with a hose, you can just make up a soapy water solution. You can buy an insecticidal soap. That's a product you can get at garden centers, or make them up with just some liquid soap and water and spray them and see if that knocks them down. Usually that will kill those soft-bodied insects. But other than that, I'm not quite sure, unless it's a hard-shelled insect, then it may be another one. So you might have to call the extension helpline and find out, see if they can help you with that.
All right. So Jan in Plainfield says, a very cute and very tubby woodchuck has avoided our have-a-heart trap for a couple of weeks now. Meanwhile, our veggie garden is suffering and almost all of my phlox has disappeared. Advice, please.
Well, I think it's a broken record here, but I keep talking about fencing
fence.
And with woodchucks, it's really important to make sure your fence goes down into the ground and then curves at a 90 degree away from the garden, so that when they try to dig underneath it, they hit that skirt of fencing. And also, if they're young woodchucks — this one sounds like a chubby one, so it might be an older one — but if they're young woodchucks, they will climb. So make sure the top of the fence is not attached to the stakes. And that way, when they do climb, the fence will just fall back down onto the ground with them, and they'll get very frustrated. They'll whistle and hiss at you, and they'll run away.
Yeah, they're called whistle pigs.
They're called whistling pigs. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Okay, Charlie, so imagine you have an army of gardeners, or a flock of gardeners, if we want to be peaceful about it. What do you want us to do right now with our gardens to just have the best season we possibly can?
With my garden?
Are
they all come to my house?
Yeah, I'll come to your house. Yeah.
Well, keep watering, because it's been really dry. Unbelievable, because it was so wet. Now we're talking, it's so dry. Keep watering, keep weeding, keep planting, keep picking, and keep deadheading. How about that? That's five keeps. They're
That's
all
a
keepers.
Lot of work.
Now you do it all at one time. You just go out early in the morning when it's nice and calm and there's no bugs out. It's cool. You can just do a little snipping here, a little pulling there, a little seeding there. Before you know, if you do that every day for a couple of weeks, you're going to have a gorgeous garden.
Snip, snip here, deadhead there. We could just sing the Wizard of Oz. As
it
we
does.
Do it. Charlie Nardozzi is a gardening consultant and the host of the Vermont Garden Journal here on VPR. If you want Charlie's expertise all to yourself and in much greater depth, we have a link to his website on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. Charlie, as always, thank you so much.
It's great to be here.